Welcome to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. Michigan is less than 2 months away from deciding who will be the next governor, and this week there were some interesting events in the race. Joining me to talk about that is our Capital correspondent Shayna Roth and Emily Lawler, a Capital reporter for the statewide impact team based out of MLive Lansing. Welcome to Current State.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hello.
In a poll of 600 likely Michigan voters conducted for the Detroit News and WDIV-TV in Detroit, showed Democrat Gretchen Whitmer holds a comfortable lead over Republican Bill Schuette. The poll showed Whitmer with 49.8% to Schuette's 36.1%. So, Emily, there has to be some concern, I think, on the Schuette's camp.
You know, I'm wondering how much concern there really is. He was obviously the front runner in all the polls in the Republican primary contest. So they do mean something to him, I do think. But, you know, I don't think this one poll is necessarily what should worry him. I think that what could be worrying is the general trend here. You know, the Real Clear Politics average of polls for this race has Whitmer up by 9 points. That's pretty significant, and he's going to be really having to, I would assume, target people that he wants to turn out to vote for him this election.
And are Republicans still feeling pretty good because this was the state that went for Trump, after all?
I mean, the risk is that you feel too comfortable at this point. So they obviously, it was a huge victory for Republicans to turn true blue presidential Michigan into a Republican win for Donald Trump. But I think that, you know, the other side of that coin is that they have to keep working just as hard to turn it red for the gubernatorial race. And I think that they recognize that. I think they're putting in place a pretty good data operation. They're really trying to get people on the ground out for Bill Schuette. You know, it's hard to replicate that kind of grassroots enthusiasm for Donald Trump, and I'm not sure if they're there yet.
And it was interesting to note how the Schuette campaign kind of preemptively tried to make lemons into lemonade with this poll. Even before it was released, they must have gotten a tip of how it was going to turn out. They had released this email blast saying that, you know, this is just more of the media trying to, you know, undermine what we're doing, and Trump's numbers were always low in the polls, and look what happened there. Donate now. So, I mean, they really tried to kind of turn this around, you know, preemptively and really quickly, and, you know, make it into a campaigning effort, which was interesting.
Yeah, and I will say that, you know, after 2016, I think everyone is right to look at polls with a little more skepticism than they may have beforehand. But, you know, I think that for me, when I look at polls, I try to see if it tracks with what I'm seeing on the ground when I'm talking to Michiganders, when I'm talking to volunteers and the respective campaigns and going to events. And I don't think that this is super off with what I'm hearing at a grassroots level either. So.
And we're talking with MLive's Emily Lawler and Capital correspondent Shayna Roth. Vice President Joe Biden was in the Southeast Michigan this week. And Shayna, you got a chance to talk with him.
Yeah, it was interesting. We got kind of a call a little bit ahead that, hey, he's going to be at Leo's Coney Island in Southfield ahead of this private fundraising event that he did for Gretchen Whitmer. And, you know, the enthusiasm for the former vice president was definitely there. The people that were in the restaurant were very excited to see him, to meet him. And he kind of, you know, did the politician thing. Like, he went around to every table, he sat down with people, he had one-on-one conversations. And what Biden was saying is that, you know, he's really looking for candidates with a certain type of character, and that this race is particularly important, and here's how he explained it.
Guys, all kidding aside, this election, more than anyone I've ever been engaged in, for Republicans and Democrats, are looking for people of character. Understand that invisible moral fabric that holds up this country, decency, honor, honesty, telling the truth, giving hate no safe harbor.
And on the same day, over in Grand Rapids, Vice President Mike Pence appeared before a rally, but not specifically to stump for Bill Schuette. Emily and Shayna, tell me how the two sides, Schuette and Whitmer, are kind of campaigning differently.
So I think that Gretchen Whitmer has this kind of grassroots going around the state, talking about how she's getting car issues on her roads plan. That's one of her number one issues. And, you know, Schuette's really trying to tap into this Trump fervor, and I'm interested to see how far he gets in that direction. But, you know, I think that as he goes around the state, it's helpful for him to be able to say that he has the support of Mike Pence, he has the support of Donald Trump. You know, he has not been shy about that, even in the general election, even though those obviously helped perhaps more in the primary election for him. So, yeah, I think he's really trying to kind of impart to voters that, you know, Donald Trump's done great things on the federal level from his viewpoint, and he would like to do those great things in the state.
And it's been interesting to really see the dynamics between the two candidates and just sort of how they are going about addressing each other. Gretchen Whitmer and her advertising seems to be more focused on her message and, you know, we got to fix the roads, we got to do this, we got to do that. She'll mention Schuette in her speeches, you know, kind of briefly, like we need to throw him a retirement party and things like that. But, you know, her ads are really more focused on this is what I can do, this is what I want to do. Whereas Schuette, he has a lot of just really kind of dark, apocalyptic-y kind of ads that feature Granholm and Gretchen Whitmer. And, you know, he's really focused on this idea that, you know, we can't go back to the Granholm administration. And do you want another Granholm? We don't want another Granholm. And I don't know how well that is going to continue to play for him if he doesn't pivot at some point, because I think there are some people that see this constant comparison as a little bit sexist. There are some other people who, you know, just don't really care. They just want to know what are your issues and where do you stand on certain things.
You know, this really tracks with both candidates' behavior in the primary election. If you think about it, Bill Schuette and Brian Kelly just beat up on each other that whole primary on the Republican side, right? That was the tactic. And if you think about the Democratic side, Gretchen Whitmer took a lot of flack and just kind of rose above it, talked about issues. I think she is really trying to stay focused on the issues, and I think Schuette is really trying to stay focused on undermining his opponent. So I think that is the dynamic going in less than 2 months away from the election. I wouldn't be surprised if it's the dynamic day of the election as well.
And we're talking with MLive's Emily Lawler and Capitol correspondent Shayna Roth. Wrapping up, let's look ahead. You know, what are we bound to see between now and election day? I'll start with you, Emily.
I think that one of the interesting dynamics is to watch is going to be how involved national groups are getting in Michigan's mm-hmm. election. Do their national supporters cut anyone loose? Do these kind of big outside PACs come in? Does spending with the sort of PACs that have already formed to support the respective candidates ramp up? I think this has the potential to shift a lot of dynamics in the next 2 months in terms of what the respective Republicans and Democrats nationally are trying to accomplish, not only with our governor's race, but our U.S. Senate race as well.
Shayna?
And just kind of bouncing off of that, I think I will be really interested to see just who comes to Michigan to stump for these candidates. You know, we've already got Joe Biden in a sort of muted visit. You know, he didn't do like a big rally, but like, are we going to see an Obama? Are we going to see an Elizabeth Warren? And on Bill Schuette's side, like, are we going to see a actual Mike Pence rally during the general? Is President Trump going to come here? Or are they kind of seeing that maybe Trump isn't going to play as well in the general and that maybe they want to kind of mute that a little bit and have Schuette kind of maybe not completely shift away, because I don't think that's possible for him, but for is he going to try and, you know, appeal to more of the moderate people and, you know, maybe say, you know, Trump stay home on this one? So, I mean, it's going to be just as interesting to see kind of who doesn't come as who does come.
Thank you very much. That was Capitol correspondent Shayna Roth and MLive's Emily Lawler.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. This week revealed yet another development in the Larry Nassar sex abuse scandal. Nassar is the former Michigan State University and USA gymnastics doctor sentenced for decades in prison after abusing women and minors that he was supposed to be treating for injuries. On Monday, former MSU field hockey player Erica Davis filed a lawsuit against MSU. It claims that Nassar drugged and raped Davis during an appointment at MSU in 1992. Davis was 17 years old at the time. The lawsuit says George Perlis, who was athletic director for part of 1992, was aware of the assault and covered it up, and campus police would not pursue it. Perlis is now an MSU trustee. WKAR Morning Edition host Emily Fox and reporter Scott Pohl pick up the details from there.
So this assault happened in 1992 when Larry Nassar was a medical student at MSU. Does this mean that this is now the earliest sexual assault case related to Nassar at Michigan State?
Well, prior to this, Emily, Larissa Boyce has said that she came forward with her story about being abused by Nassar in 1997. Up to now, we've thought of that as the first time that someone made this sort of charge against him, so 1992 would be 5 years earlier than that.
George Perlis is accused of covering up this case. Tell us how that cover-up played out in the early 90s.
Well, all of this is according to the lawsuit that was filed on Monday. It went like this. Erica Davis was a freshman on scholarship to play field hockey at MSU in 1992. After the rape that she alleges, friends convinced her to tell her coach, Martha Ludwig. Ludwig is then said to have confronted Nassar, and she obtained a videotape of the incident. She also told George Perlis, who was both athletics director and head football coach in 1992. Now, the lawsuit alleges that Perlis intervened, and that intervention came in the form of forcing Ludwig to resign from her coaching job, sign a non-disclosure agreement, and return that videotape. Perlis resigned as AD that year, but coached the football team for two more seasons. The lawsuit also alleges that the plaintiff became pregnant as a result of the rape and later miscarried. She also lost her field hockey scholarship. And a final note, Emily, that the lawsuit charges MSU police at the time with doing nothing when the rape was reported to them, indicating that it would be a mistake to take on someone with the power Perlis wielded on campus at that time.
Tell us more about George Perlis's role at the university now.
Perlis was nominated by Michigan Democrats to run for the MSU Board of Trustees back in 2006. He won an 8-year term and was re-elected to another 8-year term in 2014. So his seat on the board won't be up for election again until 2022.
You cover the MSU administration and the Board of Trustees. Victims and others have not been happy with how the board and university has handled the fallout from Larry Nassar. What do you think will happen at the university and trustee level now that Perlis has been named in this case?
Well, to say the least, the board and interim MSU president John Engler have been harshly criticized over the last year or so. There have been widespread calls for all of them to resign or for the board to fire Engler. A number of recent board meetings have been disrupted by Nassar's sister survivors, including their families, plus faculty, staff, and students known collectively as Reclaim MSU. The August 31st meeting was comparatively calm, though. Several people did speak during public comment. The next meeting is on October 26th, and it wouldn't be a surprise to see the tension ratchet up again after the filing of this lawsuit, especially targeting Perlis.
How has Michigan State University reacted to this news?
Well, university spokesperson Emily Grant issued a statement reiterating that MSU is sorry for Nassar's abuses and that these allegations are being taken seriously. What's gone unsaid so far is how John Engler or any of the trustees might be reacting, and that includes efforts to reach out to some of them, including Perlis himself. We also haven't heard back yet from attorneys representing the plaintiff.
You were just listening to WKAR reporter Scott Pohl and Morning Edition host Emily Fox discussing what may be the earliest case of sex abuse by Larry Nassar. And we need to mention the son of George Perlis said it is a, quote, fabrication that his father would have covered up a rape allegation. Pat Perlis told ESPN that allegations in a lawsuit filed Monday against MSU seem to be aimed at getting, quote, a quick payday. Also, Michigan State University Police Chief Jim Dunlap, who was an officer in 1992, said the suggestion that campus police would back down and not take a report about rape is, quote, nonsense. Follow all of our stories on the Nassar case anytime at WKAR.org. Coming up.
2 days ago, one of my friends was walking in Grand River and someone screamed from out of the car and go back to Iraq.
Learn how political rhetoric is making some international students think twice about attending class at schools like MSU. Also ahead.
Wow, this is really happening. They're actually putting my poem in the concrete.
Some Lansing residents make their permanent mark right into the sidewalks. And later, our Serving Up Science team bites into the past, present, and future of apples. Keep it here on Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. The number of international freshman applicants at Michigan State University is down almost 40% from 4 years ago. That's according to MSU's admissions office. One of the possible factors cited for the decline is a political climate that may cause some students, including those from predominantly Muslim countries, to think twice about studying in the United States. WKAR's Laura Michaels talked with two international students at MSU.
It's a sunny August day when Fatima, all safe, took a break from her summer internship to meet me for an outside interview on the campus of Michigan State University. She is wearing a red blouse covered with a white blazer and a gray hijab.
I go with both Fatima or Fatima. They're both correct. They don't have like a preference or something.
The MSU Media Information and Film Production senior hopes to make a living telling the stories of others. On this day, she tells us hers.
I know, just it's sad and I'm disappointed that's happening because I always feel like East Lansing and Michigan is my second home. And it's not okay to be scared and afraid all the time when you live at your home.
Fatima, a practicing Muslim, came to MSU in 2013 from Saudi Arabia. She says America wasn't exactly what she expected.
It's a melting pot and everyone is hating everyone.
Fatima says she felt that divisiveness escalate during President Trump's campaign and subsequent election. Then candidate Trump in December of 2015.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on?
It's not like they're more racist, more Islamophobic. It's just people had the courage to speak out that Trump is being the president now. 2 days ago, one of my friends was walking in Grand River, and someone told him, like, screamed from out of the car and said, like, go back to Iraq or something. Even though, like, he's not from Iraq, it's just like he has the Middle Eastern look.
In June, the Supreme Court upheld President Trump's travel ban, which restricts foreigners from several Muslim-majority countries. The president says the areas did not pass baseline security standards. This was his response on the day the ban was upheld.
This is a great victory for our Constitution. We have to be tough and we have to be safe and we have to be secure.
We talked to James Cotter, MSU's executive director of admissions and recruitment, before he left the position in August. The admissions office says MSU's drop in international applications is echoed throughout the U.S.
Canada. The United Kingdom, New Zealand, Australia have all experienced a significant growth in international applications in the last 12 to 24 months, during the same period in which we've seen a decrease.
There is concern that, okay, maybe now he will ban these people from these countries, but maybe that list will grow.
Dr. Muhammad Khalil, an associate professor of religious studies and director of the Muslim Studies program at Michigan State University, said when the travel ban was first proposed, some overseas students were worried about their futures in the United States.
You know, you have students who would say, well, my family's from Iran. I'm here on a visa. Can I finish my PhD? My father is dying in Iran. Can I visit him, or will that mean the end of my PhD?
My mom is Muslim, and her whole family is Muslim, and they're like the complete opposite of terrorists.
Naina Rao is a journalism student from Indonesia, the country with the largest Muslim population in the world. Rao is also a former WKAR intern.
Donald Trump is president, and there's always going to be someone that's not going to accept me and see me as an outsider without even talking to me or getting to know me.
Both Naina and Fatima have thought about returning to their home countries.
It definitely crossed my mind, like seriously crossed my mind that, you know, maybe let me just go home for a semester and see what happens.
Is it really worth the struggle? Or is it really worth the headache? These are all questions that I have in my head. But at the same time, do I really want to go home? Do I really want to stay in my comfort zone?
Fatima says through expanding her comfort zone, which includes now serving as the president of the International Students Association, she has also found friendship and support in East Lansing.
In my way, I'm kind of helping of living my life just normally and going to school, going to class, and getting myself involved in any way possible.
This is Fatima's way of bridging the cultures between the place where she grew up and the East Lansing community she now calls home. In East Lansing, Laura Michaels, WKAR News.
You are invited to join Americans in voting for their all-time favorite book. Tuesday nights at 8 o'clock, WKAR-TV presents The Great American Read. Each episode highlights 100 best-loved books selected in a national survey. WKAR education reporter Kevin Lavery and WKAR director of education Robin Pizzo sat down to talk about The Great American Read and how the votes are unfolding.
We've had a summer of reading and discussing and voting. Now this is the final push to get that most loved book by Americans throughout our nation.
How have we here in this community in mid-Michigan really built some outreach around this whole project?
We've tried to engage our community, not only in the programming, but in the importance of falling in love with reading all over again. Being able to discuss books and the diversity and variety of books that are on the list is tremendous. We've had even our PBS president in studio to discuss her favorite book.
I think that was The Great Gatsby, wasn't it?
Yes, it was The Great Gatsby. And so just really trying to engage our entire community around literature and how it shapes us as a society and how it continues to help develop us as a people.
You know, education really is the hallmark of public television, but I don't recall such a concentrated effort on a national level in quite some time focus on literacy. That tells me we have a literacy crisis in our country.
I definitely think so. I think whether it be with adults or within our K-12 system, when we look at the data, it really speaks to a greater need for everyone to get involved in reading and the importance of it being not just something used to assess, but also something used to create community and develop humanism within us. I just was able to view the Mark Twain documentary by Ken Burns, and there was a fabulous quote in there about his life and his legacy. And it said that as humans, we have to learn how to be human all over again. And that is done through books.
Robin, we have since as a country reached 2 million votes, and the initial list began with 100 books.
Mm-hmm. What happened at the 2 million mark was they did release a list of the top 40. Now, that doesn't mean that any book is out of the runnings. We want you to really dig deep and get those votes out because your vote still counts. You can go to WKAR to find that top 40 list and see if your book is on that list. And if it isn't, maybe an additional push of votes could help it get on that list.
Do you have a favorite book, Robin? Is it on this list?
I do, but I'm going to keep it a secret because I don't want to, you know, taint anyone else's selection.
Robin Pizzo is the Director of Education here at WKAR. Robin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
In East Lansing, for WKAR News, I'm Kevin Lavery.
I am doomed to remember a boy with a wrecked voice, not because of his voice, or because he was the smallest person I ever knew.
Mockingbirds don't do one thing but make music for us to enjoy. They don't eat up people's gardens, don't nest in corn cribs. They don't do one thing but sing their hearts out for us. That's why it's a sin to kill a mockingbird.
Two gin-scented tears trickled down the sides of his nose. But it was all right. Everything was all right. The struggle was finished. He had won the victory, over himself. He loved Big Brother.
Again, you can watch The Great American Read on WKAR TV 23, Tuesday nights at 8 o'clock. The grand finale is October 23rd. If you've taken a stroll around Lansing over the past couple of weeks, you might have seen something on the sidewalk. Poetry. WKAR's Jamie Paisley explains.
Imagine you're heading to grab a bite in Old Town Lansing, or taking a game at Cooley Law School Stadium, but there's this stuff on the ground that catches your eye. It's not chalk or anything, it's words engraved in the pavement itself. This is the Lansing Sidewalk Poetry Project. Here's one of the organizers, Rulaine Stokes, president of the Lansing Poetry Club, at the opening gala, which was held at the Lansing Art Gallery in downtown.
It's a grant from the City of Lansing through the Lansing Economic Development Corporation and the Arts Council of Greater Lansing to elicit poems about place, about people's connection to specifically four neighborhoods in Lansing: Old Town, Rio Town, the Stadium District, and the East Side. We got 76 submissions, and then we had a panel of judges who worked to try and narrow it down to 8 poems. And then we had our winners, and then the whole process of engraving the poems in the sidewalk. So it's been a 9-month process.
Even before this official launch of the Lansing Sidewalk Poetry Project, Lansing Mayor Andy Shore had a poetry run-in while out with a City Hall colleague.
We took the Grab and Go, the new shuttle, up to Old Town and had lunch. And there it was on the sidewalk. It was really exciting. You know, you talk about it and you hear about it, and then you see it right there on the street. So it was awesome. It's an important part of who we are in Lansing. We are artistic. We are cultural. We love to share about ourselves. And now you can walk down the street and see poetry right on the street. It's part of the atmosphere.
Another of the organizers of the Sidewalk Poetry Project is Lansing's inaugural poet laureate, Dennis Heinrichsen. Now, Heinrichsen didn't know how this project would go, either in terms of entries that came in or where across Lansing the poetry would physically go.
No, it was there was no way to actually identify the spots prior to identifying the winners, because this is about place. So the poem determined the place. So once we had the 8 winners, I got my tape measure and I drove around town looking for clean concrete and tried to match the poem with place so that it resonated. So when you look at a poem about the Shiawassee Street Bridge, you are looking at the bridge. When you're reading a poem about Old Town and its Hispanic heritage in the Brinke Fish Ladder, you're standing on the Brinke Fish Ladder.
And the poet whose work is now on permanent display at the Brinke Fish Ladder in Old Town Lansing is Cruz Villarreal. The engraving of his poem, Mi Pueblo, was something he definitely wasn't going to miss when the time came.
Dennis calls me up and says, "Hey, dude, they're putting in your poem." And so I, you know, slam on the brakes, turn around, head to the ladder. And oh my God, that's when it all, you know, like, wow, this is really happening. They're actually putting my poem in the concrete. I'm in stone, dude.
And it was simple as for why Old Town is important to Villarreal.
Any community action that's taken place in Lansing was born there. It was where Latinos congregated. It's where anything, any kind of activism or any issue that needed to be resolved was born in Old Town, Northside, right? That's why the poem has that. That's why it's in Spanish and English. It's a marriage. That Latino heritage there, that history there, now I feel like it's not going to go away.
We've placed a map of the 8 locations to the Lansing Sidewalk Poetry online at WKAR.org. In Lansing, Jamie Paisley, WKAR News.
She's an immigrant, a doctor, and the new president of Planned Parenthood.
We've gotten away from the art of medicine and also from the fundamentals of listening to the patient and listening to the story.
Next, we open our archives for a chat with Dr. Lena Nguyen. Also, how did American apples become so red and so hearty? Our Serving Up Science team shares the history of the fruit and how it may change in the future. You're listening to Current State on WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. This week, Dr. Lena Nguyen was named the new president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Dr. Nguyen was formerly health commissioner for the city of Baltimore. In 2013, she authored the book, When Doctors Don't Listen, How to Avoid Misdiagnosis and Unnecessary Tests. Let's open the archives now and share an interview in 2014 by former WKAR Morning Edition host Melissa Benmark. We start with Dr. Nguyen explaining how her book tour turned into a listening tour.
I went into my speaking tour thinking that I would talk to patients about their health and how to advocate for health. Part of why I wrote my book was based on my own experiences with my mother in getting misdiagnosed and also feeling very disconnected from our healthcare. And so I had a number of tips and advice that I wanted to share with readers. As I spoke to people about their healthcare, though, I realized that everybody had their own story and they all had their own experiences from their healthcare experiences, some good, some bad. But there was a lot of mistrust and also a lot of fear. That was a medicine, and it was helpful for me to hear that from each person's perspective, not just from each patient's perspective, but from the experiences of people as patients and also as caregivers themselves.
Talk about the phenomenon of people being afraid to question what their doctors say. You know, a certain age of people just don't feel like it's right to question their doctors, especially.
There are patients, particularly who are older, who are immigrants, but also just people in general, we're conditioned to think of our physician almost as our parent. That the doctor says, take this medication, and you say, sure, or this doctor says, do this test, and you don't ask why. And part of that is cultural, part of that is our societal expectation, but there's also this deeply entrenched fear that perhaps if we speak up to our doctor, somehow that doctor is going to retaliate. We saw this in a Seinfeld episode where Elaine was fired by her doctor, and a lot of us have this fear. And yet, especially in today's healthcare system where doctors are limited with less and less time with their patients, it's even more important now more than ever to speak up and address your own concerns and make sure your doctor understands you and really listens to you.
Then there's kind of the opposite problem of with resources available to people online where, you know, people come in and they tell their doctors, well, I saw this and this on the web and I know I have this and I know this is the treatment and that's what I want. Thank you very much. That's sort of the opposite problem, but I can imagine that must be kind of frustrating as well.
That's right. That's the opposite side of the spectrum, right? That there are some patients who come in, and I'm exaggerating only a little bit here, that some patients will come in with 200 pages of Google printouts and say, I need these five medications and these three tests. And the implication is that if you as the doctor don't give those things to me that I demand, I will go somewhere else. I also don't think that's helpful for the doctor-patient relationship because ultimately the relationship should be a partnership. I encourage my patients to say to their doctor, I'm the expert when it comes to my body. You're the expert when it comes to medicine. Let's work together to figure out what's best for me. And if you come in with either the attitude of, I know everything that's best for me and you have to do this, or then I'm going to keep my mouth shut and do everything you say, then either of those two extremes will result in really misdiagnoses and in things being done that shouldn't be.
It seems like healthcare has become so politicized, and not just, maybe it always has been, because I think back to the Clinton administration and, you know, some pushback they got on changing healthcare at all, and then, you know, the Obamacare question. And I think at the end of the day, people get cranked up because they're scared. You know, they're talking about stuff that they feel affects their mortality, what kind of family structure they have, really basic things. Do you have any ideas about how to dial down the rhetoric and actually work on making effective changes?
Yeah, so that is one of the key lessons that I learned in this listening tour, actually. You know, I'm in D.C., and I'm exposed all the time to policy and politics and people talking about ECA and ACOs and Medicaid expansion and all these fancy policy terms that, as you just said, are mired in rhetoric and mired in really in politics. But when you ask people what is it that they want from their health care, what people want is to be treated by someone who's competent and caring and compassionate and to get good quality, effective health care that's not going to bankrupt them. That's not too much to ask. I think that's something that all of us in this society should be entitled to. And for me, what rings true is the quote by Tip O'Neill that all politics is local, and the corollary for that is all medicine is personal. And for me, we should boil down the rhetoric to what is the most important in the interaction between the individual doctor and the individual patient. So in a way, start backwards. Don't just work from the politics and say, well, this is what Republicans or Democrats want, but rather start from the basics of what is it that the patient needs and how can that doctor be enabled to provide what it is that the patient needs or what are the policies that we can develop around that. So I think that's what we have to come down to. How do we break down all the fear and enable trust and enable doctors who are highly trained and who are compassionate to practice in the way that they know is the right thing to do.
If you look at healthcare systems around the world, do you see any models, you know, obviously nothing's perfect, but do you see any models that you feel like they're working most of the time?
That's a great question. Nothing, as you said, is perfect. I'll give you some examples of things that are working well in some ways and perhaps are not working in other ways. I'm Chinese and I was born in China. When I was growing up, there was healthcare available for all. There was actually a quite robust healthcare system. As China developed, though, the policies and politics got developed such that China has become purely a fee-for-service system, where if you are wealthy and you have great access to care, then you can get just about anything you need. But if you're not, then you really can't get anything at all. Sorry?
I'm sorry, I need to interrupt you for a second. China doesn't have universal healthcare anymore.
The access to universal health care was abandoned back in the 1980s, along with the rest of the economic reforms that were done, too.
No kidding.
So there are plenty of people who do not have access to health care and who basically everything is, if you pay for something, you will get it. But plenty of people go without because they know that they can't actually afford it. And so I'm afraid that the U.S. is going down a similar path and that unless we get some national commitment to this is the access that we need and this is the coverage that we want to provide to all of our citizens, that we'll also end up in a similar system. I think there are more examples of systems that don't work than there are systems of that do work.
What do you think is the single largest issue, if there is a, I mean, no, everything is connected, so, but what do you think is maybe the biggest issue affecting the quality of healthcare in the U.S. today?
There are a number of interrelated issues. A lot of them boil down to our belief that technology is the answer. You know, we know from multiple studies done now from the 50s, 60s, 70s, all the way until present day that your diagnosis can be made 80% of the time just based on the history. That's the story of your illness alone. All the physical exam, every single test and blood tests and CT scans and MRIs, everything added together can add only 20% to that diagnosis, which I think is remarkable because if you think about the billions of dollars that are invested into developing better testing, think about how many billions you hear being developed into getting a better history, right? We don't hear that at all. And in fact, doctors have less and less time now to even listen and elicit that story from their patients. And so we've gotten away from the art of medicine, and also from the fundamentals of listening to the patient and listening to the story. And that, I think, is contributing to a lot of other dynamics in medicine that are against what is it that's actually helpful for providing medical care, that's making patients and doctors more disconnected, that's making healthcare even more expensive, and that's, in turn, contributing to less access to healthcare, too.
It almost sounds like the medical world needs interviewers.
That's right. And we need people who are able to listen and who are trained to elicit the story and understand what's going on with their patients.
My mother was a hospital chaplain for over a decade. And one of the things that she noticed was that the people in the faith world who did that kind of work got burnt out. They were there for everybody, and not very many people were there for them. And I have to wonder the same thing as you tell me about how much pressure doctors are under and how much time they don't have, and the financial pressures and the time pressures. Who takes care of the doctors in all this?
There is a very high degree of burnout among practicing physicians, and I suspect that part of it is exactly what you said, that there is all this pressure on doctors that come from patients and their needs, but also from the healthcare system, too. Doctors are under more and more pressure now to see as many patients as possible, to do as much billing as possible, but to keep costs low for patients. And also there are increasing pressures to do a certain checklist of things. Every patient needs to have a checklist of review systems, to have a checklist of things that need to be followed. And while all of this ideally will enhance patient care, that does put more demands on patients or on doctors' time. And so part of this is that doctors have to get better support and that our healthcare system has to change. But you're right that there needs to be better support for doctors in the system as well.
Well, Dr. Lena Nguyen, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
Again, that was former WKAR Morning Edition host Melissa Benmark in a 2014 interview with Dr. Lena Nguyen, the author of When Doctors Don't Listen, How to Avoid Misdiagnosis and Unnecessary Tests. This week, Dr. Nguyen was named the new president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America after spending several years as the health commissioner for the city of Baltimore.
Food is the language everyone speaks, but do we truly understand it?
Between the conversations over organic food and GMOs, different diets taking the world by storm, and how what we eat actually impacts our environment,
there's no shortage of things to learn about. Hi, I'm Karel Vega.
And I'm Cheryl Kirschenbaum, and this is Serving Up Science.
Good riddance to the blandest of all apples, Red Delicious.
Excuse me?
I'm pretty excited for apple season.
I can tell.
Let's just stop that right there. I like them, but not as much as Raffi does.
It sounds like you're not a big fan of the long-reigning apple champion, Red Delicious. And that's been our country's most grown variety for over half a century.
No, definitely not. Red Delicious, there's so many great apples. You got Honeycrisp, Gala, Fuji. By comparison, the Red Delicious is just so boring. I would even go as far as calling it flavorless.
Well, it's definitely not as crispy, but it wasn't always the case, Karel. We made it that way. The bright red variety we've come to expect as Red Delicious, distinctive with an elongated shape and that five-point base, it's changed over the years.
But let's start this story off with its birth. In the 1700s, apples themselves were a staple in colonial America. Not just to eat, either. Colonists used apples for a variety of things, including cider, as an alternative to water, which might not taste or even be so good back then.
And our now famous...
You mean infamous...
Red Delicious variety came onto the scene in the late 1800s. The story goes that a farmer named Jesse Hyatt let a certain apple tree grow on his property after many unsuccessful attempts to kill it.
Well, maybe he should have tried a little harder.
Well, Jesse entered the fruit he had named Hawkeye into an apple competition during the 1890s, and he won.
He then sold the rights to the Stark brothers, who had hosted the competition.
And they renamed this new apple Delicious, but eventually Red Delicious, since they also sold Golden Delicious apples as well.
But it probably didn't taste like the Red Delicious apples we've become accustomed to in the 21st century.
You mean the ones that you despise?
The very same. As the number of local farms declined and more shoppers turned to markets for produce during the 20th century, customers preferred the look of a particular type of apple.
Americans wanted deep, dark red apples because they associated the color with ripeness.
Both apple growers and supermarkets were happy to appease them, and Red Delicious apples were bred to meet expectations, which came at the expense of taste and texture.
Elsewhere, farmers and scientists continued producing sweeter and crisper varieties, like the Honeycrisp developed at the University of Minnesota in the early 1990s.
That is my favorite, and there are more coming. All over the U.S. and the world, apple breeders are combining the best traits out there to create new and exciting variations. In fact, a group of breeders out of Ohio called the Midwest Apple Improvement Association have developed an apple they're calling Evercrisp, which they say combines the best traits of Honeycrisp and Fuji apples. And not to be outdone, the same folks out of the University of Minnesota have bred the Rave Apple, which shares traits similar to the Honeycrisp, but reaches its peak ripeness about a month earlier.
So it's not surprising that the demand for new Red Delicious trees has gone down with so many tasty options out there.
But for listeners who still love a good Red Delicious, don't be too concerned. The traditional favorite is still projected to be the second most popular apple by production in the U.S. this season after the Gala.
And the Granny Smith will be third, followed by Fuji, and then our favorite, the Honeycrisp, which is predicted to continue its rise.
With some experts speculating it might be our third most popular apple as early as 2020.
And I know you'll be looking forward to that.
I'm just going
to
enjoy apple season and the fall, and I hope our listeners do as well.
You've been listening to Serving Up Science, the series all about food, where it comes from, and how it impacts our health and our planet.
This program is produced at Michigan State University in association with Food at MSU. I'm Karel Vega.
And I'm Cheryl Kirschenbaum, and this is WKAR.
And you can hear Serving Up Science Wednesdays at 4:45 and 6:45 p.m. during All Things Considered on 90.5 WKAR. Your NPR station for the Capital Region. Every month, our colleagues on the classical side share a new release of the month. The September choice comes courtesy of our afternoon classical host, Jamie Paisley.
It begins with one of the most famous flute lines in history, and it's played deftly by the principal flute of the Philharmonia Orchestra, Samuel Coles. 2018 marks 100 years since the passing of composer Claude Debussy, and the Philharmonia Orchestra has released an album of three works by the French impressionistic master. It begins with the soft flute and textures that are lighter than most recordings of the famed Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun. But the music of Frenchman Claude Debussy didn't come easy to the Spanish conductor of this recording, the rising star Pablo Harris Casado.
Debussy always created in me a very a huge respect. I mean, as any composer, of course, but I always thought that was a music that was a bit more distant to me, I don't know why. But then, after my first experiences, I realized that there was very much part of myself.
The middle of this Philharmonia Orchestra album that we've chosen as the 90.5 classical new release of the month features a lesser-known bit of Debussy's work, a musical play he composed called The Martyrdom of Saint Sebastian. It's obscure, but in these symphonic fragments, you hear that more dramatic side of Debussy. For the conductor of this album, Pablo Heras Casado, the trick to making these Debussy works fresh was to chamberize the pieces, essentially, to pare things down.
Regardless the size of the orchestration, the size of the piece, the length of the piece you are working with, you always have to treat himself as the most intimate chamber music. In every single moment of the piece, it's plenty of tonalities, colors, and that's really challenging, but it's really wonderful.
The finale of this Philharmonia Orchestra album, led by Pablo Heras Casado, is the sweeping work La Mer, or The Sea. Pablo Heras Casado leading the Philharmonia Orchestra in a trio of works by Claude Debussy on this Harmonia Mundi album, chosen as the 90.5 Classical New Release of the Month for September. For WKAR, I'm Jamie Paisley, and you can find a link to this album online at WKAR.org.
With that, we'll say thank you for joining us on this lovely September weekend in the Capital Region. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. For the entire WKAR News team, thank you for listening, and we'll connect with you again next weekend.